Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on We Establish the Law with the Broken Covenant. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. In Romans chapter 3 and verse 31, the Lord said this through Paul, "Do we then make void the law through faith? Certainly not. On the contrary, we establish the law." And that is what we are seeking to do through this series. We establish the law. Now we have seen that the Ten Commandments were, in fact, the ten terms of a covenant God made with the people of Israel. And we saw that in Exodus chapter 34 and verse 28, where it says of Moses, "So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments." So the Ten Commandments were the words, or we would call them the terms, of the covenant that God made with Israel. And they were the terms that Israel was to keep. And yet Israel did not keep this covenant longer than a very short time. However, the covenant was kept for a time by Israel. Now we saw back in Exodus chapter 19 that God proposed the covenant to Israel, that they accepted it, and then the terms were revealed. We see that in Exodus chapter 19, starting in verse 3, where we read, "And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." And of course, if we'd studied through the books of Exodus, we would have seen what the Lord was talking about. First of all, the 10 plagues that he brought on the Egyptians. That's what he means when he says what he did to the Egyptians. And then how he bore them on eagle's wings to bring them to himself. Now, we read of a census that the Lord took of the children of Israel when they were out in the wilderness. And we see that the results of that census were that there were counted that there were 600,000 Israelite males who were of age to be in the army, who drew the sword. 600,000. Now, if we would assume an equal number of women to men, which is a good assumption, then we would have 600,000 women that same age as well. And then, of course, you would have the men who are too old to be in the army, and the boys and girls who are too young to bear the sword and be in the army. And we would have a considerable number of Israelites. In fact, if we were to make a conservative estimate, and this would be conservative mind, we could estimate that there were 2 million Israelites who came out of Egypt. For 600,000 men of sword-bearing age, I think that's a very conservative estimate. It could have been twice that number. But just take a conservative number and say that there were 2 million Israelites who came out of Egypt. Now they came out with all their possessions and with all their animals. But consider, just for the sake of argument, if these Israelites came out and they came out 10 abreast. 10 abreast, right? 10 walking side by side with 10 feet in between each row. And they were to spread out in a line that way. Now, if we would compare that to distances in the United States, well, I live in the Twin Cities area. And if the Israelite line was to start at the old train depot in St. Paul and head toward the train depot in Chicago, remember, 10 people side by side and 10 feet in between each row of people. Well, by the time the last row was leaving the St. Paul train station, the first row would only be about 30 miles away from the Chicago train station. In other words, the line would almost reach from St. Paul to Chicago, just be 30 miles short. And that's how long the line would be if the Israelites had come out. If there were 2 million, like I said, a conservative estimate, and they came out 10 side by side with 10 feet in between each row, it would stretch almost from St. Paul to Chicago in the line of Israelites. Now imagine bringing 2 million people out of Egypt in one night. when there are that many people? And yet God did it. He brought them out of Egypt in one night. And that really was a miracle. We might say that was even greater than the miracles of the 10 plagues. The miracle when God brought Israel out of Egypt in one night, 2 million or more people. That's an incredible miracle. That's a logistical nightmare. There's no way humanly you could do that. And yet the Lord had done that. He had truly brought them to himself on eagle's wings. Exodus 19:5. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. So Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do." So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. So what do we see here? Well, we see the Lord offering to make an agreement with the people of Israel. And he doesn't tell them what the agreement is going to be, notice. Instead, he pleads with them based on what he had done for them in the past. Based on the fact that he had conquered the Egyptians for them. Based on the fact that he had taken them out of Egypt on eagle's wings. Well, based on all that, he believes that they could agree to obey him and keep his agreement even before they knew what it was. And they accepted it. Now, this is not strange because God can be trusted. You could take a blank sheet of paper, sign your name at the bottom, and then give it to God and say, "Here, fill in a contract. I don't know what it's going to be, but my signature's already on it. Whatever you write up, I'll accept it." Why? Because we can know he would be fair. And not only that, he is so gracious and generous, he would be favorable to us in the agreement he would make. So you could sign a contract not even knowing what it was, and you could know it would be a good contract if the other party is God. And that's what Israel does, and that's what they should have done. That was good. Now, the terms of the covenant that God offered to them, once he revealed it, they were not unreasonable nor impossible. They were the Ten Commandments, as we saw. And those commandments were things that they already should have been doing. Seeing that the Lord had rescued them from Egypt, they certainly shouldn't have had any other gods besides him. Seeing that he was not an idol, they certainly shouldn't have made any idols. Certainly, they should have kept the Lord's name holy and not used it in vain. As good people, they should have honored their parents, their fathers and mothers. As good people, they should not have murdered. They should not have committed adultery. All these terms were things that a faithful Israelite was already doing before God even made the agreement with them. So certainly these terms were not unreasonable nor impossible. They were just 9 things that any good person would do. And then the 10th thing, of course, was keeping the Sabbath day, 1 day in 7, resting from their labor. Well, that was not burdensome at all. That was a good agreement. And if they would just do that, he was going to make them his special nation, a kingdom of priests, a special treasure to him above all people, and a holy nation. So they made this agreement with God. And Israel kept their agreement with God from Exodus 20, where the terms of the agreement were given, all the way to Exodus 32, where they broke it. Now, between Exodus 20 and Exodus 32 was a period of about 47 days that elapsed. And during those 47 days, they kept the law. They kept the covenant. They kept their agreement with God for 47 days. Now, if they could do it for 47 days, and they did. Well, if they could do it for 47 days, well, then they could have done it for 47 weeks. And if they could have done it for 47 weeks, then they could have done it for 47 months. And if they could have done it for 47 months, then they could have done it even for 47 years. And so on in perpetuity. They could have kept the covenant. There was nothing saying that they couldn't. Now, during those 47 days when Israel kept the covenant, they were really in the most favorable position that Israel was ever in. Why was that? Well, that was because they had an agreement with God, and they were keeping it. And soon he would come through on his part of the agreement and would make them, in reality, a peculiar treasure unto himself. And that doesn't mean strange or odd, but that means special, different from all other people. He would make them his special treasure. He would make them a kingdom of priests, a go-between nation between him and all the other nations. They would represent God to the other nations and the other nations to God. And they would therefore be a holy, a set-apart nation to God. And that was what they were standing ready to be during those 47 days. And if they just waited a little longer and kept the covenant, that's what they would have become. However, sadly, the covenant was broken. And we see that in Exodus chapter 32. We're starting in verse 1, we read, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron." Remember, Aaron was Moses' brother, the one whom the Lord made the priest. And of course, he was in charge while Moses was up on the mountain. "So they gathered together to Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.'" So what happened here? Well, their leader Moses remained in the mountain for 40 days, and they didn't see him at all. And then they became uneasy, and I believe they began to panic and to give way to their emotions. Now, this is a most strange thing, because the Lord had actually come down to Mount Sinai to meet with Moses in the sight of the people. And they had seen when he had come down on the mountain, the whole top of the mountain had been, as the King James described it, on a smoke. And the whole top of the mountain was smoking, like it was a giant furnace. And the glory of the Lord came down and rested on the mountain, and there was the sound of a trumpet getting louder and louder and louder as the Lord came down. And the whole mountain, Mount Sinai, trembled and shook. Now imagine if you saw that, what an awe-inspiring sight that would be, knowing that the God who created everything was coming down, and his presence was resting on top of that mountain, and you could see it, and you could see the mountain smoking and shaking and hear the trumpet blaring to announce his arrival. What an incredible thing that must have been. And certainly you must have realized the reality and the power of this God when you saw that. But how in the world could sane, reasonable people, 40 days after seeing that, not only that, but the Lord's presence was still there. And it doesn't say for sure, but I would tend to think that the mountain was still smoking. I mean, probably the trumpet announcing his arrival stopped, and maybe the mountain stopped shaking. But his presence was still there, and I think it was still hidden by the smoke. The whole top of the mountain was still smoking like it was on fire. And the children of Israel could just look up and see the mountain smoking and see where the presence of God was. And yet seeing that, they turn around and say, forget that God, let's make an idol instead. How could they do that? How could thinking reasonable people do such a thing? Well, I think we can't really know for sure because we aren't of their number. We aren't of that time or of that culture, their mindset. But I think if we try to put ourselves in their mindsets, maybe we can. Understand that these people had grown up in Egypt, and the Egyptians were idolaters. And every indication in the Bible is that the Israelites had taken up idolatry as well while they were in Egypt. So they had grown up in a household where there was a household god, an idol. And that god was sitting there in the corner, and your parents would tell you, that god is our family god. He's watching over us. He's watching over our family. And so you would look over in that corner, you'd see that statue sitting there. Maybe it looks friendly sitting there and innocent sitting there in your house, and you think, ah, that's our God. He's watching over us. He's on our side. And you feel comforted and it makes you feel good and give you warm, fuzzy feelings. But now, compare that to now. They're out in the wilderness facing the God who had parted the Red Sea so they could pass through it. And they had seen him come down on the mountain and the mountain tremble and shake and smoke and the sound of a trumpet. And it's all kind of frightening. It's scary. Being in the presence of the really real God is a frightening thing. It's not comforting. It doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling. It can be a scary thing to be in relationship with a really real God, with all his power and majesty and greatness. And maybe they thought back with some nostalgia and some longing to those nice, peaceful little statues sitting in the corner of their house, just kind of smiling at them and not doing anything frightening or scary. And they're wishing they could go back to that. So as mad as it might seem, in the presence of God, seeing him right up there on the mountain causing the whole mountain to smoke to say, let's go back to idols, well, maybe we can understand it. Even today, there are many people, I think, who would rather have the nice, comfortable, little safe religion of their youth, the nice little religious practices and things that they grew up with that always gave them comfort. They would rather have just those religious things than have a real relationship with a really real God, which even today can be a frightening thing. So maybe those Israelites aren't as different from us as we might think. Verse 2, and Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. Now you might be wondering, how did all these former Egyptian slaves have all this gold? But remember, when the Israelites went out of Egypt, the Bible tells us that they spoiled the Egyptians. They basically asked the Egyptians for things, said, "Hey, give me that wealth over there. Give me that money you have." And the Egyptians gave it to them freely. And the Lord had told them to do that. Ask your neighbors to give you their things. Now, I think the reason the Lord told them to do that is that the people of Israel really were always the Lord's people. And yet the Egyptians had made them slaves in defiance of the Lord. And as slaves, they had not paid them wages like you would pay to a free employee. So by having them spoil the Egyptians, the Lord was basically having them take back all the back wages that the Egyptians hadn't paid them during all those years that they had benefited from their labor and had made them slaves. So they spoiled the Egyptians, and when they came out of Egypt, they were a rich people. So they had all these golden earrings in the ears of their wives and sons and daughters. And yes, men wore earrings too at the time. Of course, that's not our custom today. So they all took these earrings, gave them to Aaron, and he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And we happen to know that a calf idol was one of the gods of Egypt. Then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Well, now they're just basically playing let's pretend. I mean, they know who the God is who brought them out of Egypt. But like I said, he's a frightening thing, and they would rather think that this idol did it. And so that's what they tell themselves. Verse 5, so when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast of the Lord." Now here we see kind of the ultimate hypocrisy. Is after turning their backs on the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, the true God who had brought them out of Egypt, they make this calf idol, and then they claim, when we're worshiping this calf idol, we're actually worshiping the Lord. Well, could you worship the Lord by doing it in a way that the Lord has specifically forbidden? No, of course not. You can't worship the Lord a way that he forbid you to do. Yet that's what they did. They worshiped their calf idol and pretended it was worshiping the Lord. Verse 6, then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And if you have any notion of what idolatrous worship was like at the time, you realize how licentious this play probably was. Now, the people demanded Aaron make them gods to worship instead of the true God. And that was a grievous sin, no doubt about it. However, the Lord had made a covenant with Israel. And so this was not only just a grievous sin, but it also broke the first two terms of the covenant, having no other gods before him and not making graven images. Now, it is true that to make a golden calf and to worship it would have been a sin for the around 2,500 years of human history that had elapsed before the Ten Commandments. But after Sinai, after the covenant, it was more than just a sin for Israel to do this. It also broke the covenant. And that was a terrible sin. Jeremiah 31:32 says, "Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Lord." So the Lord actually compares their breaking the covenant to breaking marriage vows. That was what it was like when the Israelites worshipped this golden calf. Now, when it came to breaking this covenant, there was no second chance to keep it. The old saying, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Well, that did not apply here. And notice that, it's starting in verse 7 of Exodus 32. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf, and worshipped it and sacrificed to it, and said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." So the Lord knew, and he reviews exactly what they had done. Verse 9, "And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. And I will make of you a great nation." So the Lord is ready to consume them, to destroy them utterly for what they had done. And that shows us that the covenant, like I said, once broken, it was a broken covenant. It was a broken agreement. It could not be restored. There was no second chance or try again. However, Moses advocated for the people. Verse 11. "Then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn your fierce wrath, and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. And all this land that I have spoken of I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever." So Moses pleads with the Lord to spare the people, and he pleads with him based on three arguments. First of all, the Egyptians. He says, "The Egyptians saw how you made them your people and brought them out of Egypt. Well, if now you destroy them, the Egyptians will think, well, the Lord wasn't actually their loving God after all. He just took them out of Egypt to kill them in the mountains." And so he says, what will the Egyptians think? And the Lord always cares about his great name, his great reputation. So he says, you wouldn't want the Egyptians to think that. Secondly, he pleads with him on behalf of his people of the past, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, his servants. He says, remember them and spare their descendants for their sakes. And third, he pleads by his own promise that he would multiply their descendants as the stars of heaven. So after Moses pleads with the Lord, verse 13, "So the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people." So Moses' advocacy was the only thing that spared the people from the consequences of their actions. And remember, if the Lord had done what he said, if he had destroyed the Israelites and made out of Moses' descendants a great nation, well, that would have fulfilled his promises just as much as doing it through those 12 tribes. So the Lord could have still fulfilled his promises and destroyed the people. And yet Moses stood in for them to spare them. Verse 15, "And Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. The tablets were written on both sides. On the one side and on the other they were written. Now the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there is a noise of war in the camp. But he said, it is not the noise of the shout of victory, nor the noise of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear. So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. So Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. Then he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, and ground it to powder, and he scattered it on the water and made the children of Israel drink it." So when Moses saw the evidence of the people breaking the covenant, he shattered the record of the covenant at the foot of the mountain. And that's really what had happened to the covenant. It had been shattered. Now, there's a very interesting verse in Exodus 32:29, and I'm going to read it out of the King James Version instead of my usual New King James, where it says, "For Moses had said, consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, even every man upon his son and upon his brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day." And I tend to think that the people broke the covenant on the very day the Lord intended to bestow on them a blessing. And I think that blessing probably would have been making them the special treasure, the kingdom of priests, and the holy nation. But instead, there was no blessing. Verse 30. "Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses said to the people, you have committed a great sin. So now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So, because of their great sin, there was no blessing. Perhaps on the very day he would have transferred the law from the tables of stone to the fleshy tables of their hearts, they broke the covenant, and that was the end of their agreement. Well, we'll never know what would have happened if they hadn't broken it, of course, because they did. So the Ten Commandments were the 10 terms of a covenant God made with Israel. They kept this covenant for 47 days, which shows they could have kept it longer. However, they then broke the covenant, and they would receive no second chance to keep the covenant. Their covenant with God was not, if at first you don't succeed, try again. The blessings that the covenant promised could never be theirs under this covenant, once they had broken it. What would the Lord do now? We'll discuss that in our next message.
Two of the 10 terms of God's covenant with Israel were broken at the foot of Mount Sinai when Israel worshiped the golden calf that Aaron made. Through the pleas of Moses, God's anger was abated, preserving God's name. The answer for what this now means for Israel will have to wait for our next program. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the broken covenant. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on We Established the Law with Israel Under the Law. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that as you study God's Word more and more, you know God more and more. For more information on this program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible Studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org. I'm your host, Bob Juneau, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. We'll say goodbye for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.